You're listening to audio from Liberty Church Coomera. For more information about our family of churches, visit us online at liberty.church.
Open your Bibles to the book of Esther, and I want to start with a question because we are beginning a new series in the book of Esther. Now, quick show of hands, who did their homework and read the book of Esther and counted the number of times God's name was mentioned? Hands up. Heads up if you just ignored that command, instruction, brilliant. I love the honesty, gospel of grace here at Liberty Coomera. Well, we're going to tuck into the book of Esther, but I'm going to start by asking a question. Can you tell me or can you remember one of the best celebrations you have ever been to? Can you think back to one of the best celebrations you have ever been to? Perhaps it was a wedding where the atmosphere was electric, the dance floor was just happening, and maybe it was your wedding and this was the moment, bride and groom, wonderful. Maybe it was a 40th. Maybe someone's 40th and you just remember, we just laughed into the night. Maybe it was a 50th and the night ended about 8:30 and you just got to bed and you're like, that was wild, that was good. We love festivals, we love parties, we love celebrations, and we enter the story of Esther looking at the festival of Purim. This is a Jewish festival that has been celebrated for thousands of years. And it is a fun festival. There is feasting, there is dancing, there is someone who reads the story of Esther as everyone listens in. There are costumes, there are particular foods you eat on the festival of Purim. This really is quite the party. The Jews know how to celebrate. Raises the question, what are they celebrating? What is this festival of Purim and why is it such an important occasion to celebrate? Well, it's a celebration of how the Jews escaped extermination after a plot was discovered and followed by Queen Esther. It centers around this Cinderella-like tale of a poor Jewish girl who rises to become queen in the land. Her name is Esther. It's this kind of Marvel comic universe origin story. How did Esther begin? But it's not just about Esther. It's actually about God's people. And it's not just about God's people. It's about God. The book of Esther, in one sense, is asking the question, or answering the question, how is it that the Jews are still here? How is it that we as God's people are still alive? Because it was a troubling time for Israel. Israel had been sent into exile. Kids, imagine, this is like being grounded, but you're kind of banished away from the rest of life. You have to go to your room, but in your room there is no technology, so it's just you away from all the things you love. This is exile. They're sent away from where they were meant to be living. God promised them through disobedience, so they're under King Nebuchadnezzar's reign and rule, and for 70 years they're in exile. Looks like they're defeated. Looks like they're going to be wiped out. Then the Babylonian Empire is now taken over by the Persians. And here they are now reigning and ruling. After 7 years, some Jews had returned home, but some just remained scattered throughout the Persian Empire. The people of God lived in the margins of society. They were powerless. They were under the oppressive force of the day. They had no cultural power. Maybe you feel a bit like that this morning. This force, this cultural force, had put in decree that one day, in a few months' time, every Jew was to be annihilated. Every Jew was to be killed. This is about to happen. That's what's happening. That's what moves the plot line of Esther along. Which raises for us, if you're a Jew, all these kind of questions. Could God let this happen to the Jews? Could God let his people be wiped out? The laws of the Persians could not be repealed. It could not be changed. So how will God protect his people? It raises question like, is God here? Is God present? Have we been abandoned through exile? Is God going to come through? Where is God if this is what is happening? In fact, the most obvious reality about the book of Esther is that God is not named. His name does not come up in the whole book. And maybe you find this kind of absence or hiddenness of God at certain times in your own life. Maybe you've had seasons where you just wonder, God, are you even there? Do you understand what I'm walking through right now? If you were really here, why don't you be more obvious? God, if you were present, this may not have happened. Is God at work? Is he doing anything? The hiddenness of God, sometimes he's hard to see. But the absence of God's name is there to make us wonder, huh, I wonder what God is doing. Because I can't clearly see his name, but I wonder if God is perhaps at work. And that is the goal of Esther. It is an invitation to invite us in to see if we can trace the hidden hand of God. If we can see where God is at work through this story. So we jump into the story, and today we're going to look at chapter 1, and we're going to begin with our first character. His name in Greek is Xerxes. He has a Hebrew name that you're going to enjoy pronouncing this whole time that we're together. Ahasuerus is how we're going to pronounce it. It'll probably come out different every time. But we're excited about that. So King Ahasuerus, here he is. And in the opening verses, the story begins with this once upon a time kind of feel. So kids, this is the part where you listen. This is like once upon a time. Now in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel. In the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. So the story begins. It gives us a location. It's taking place here in Susa, the Persian capital, and it's the reign of King Ahasuerus. It's a real place. It's a real time. This is not fable. This is not fantasy. This is not parable. You can look up this stuff in history. And the king's reign and rule is huge. 127 provinces. This is modern day Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Egypt, Libya, Northern Sudan, parts of Greece. He's basically the boss. He dominates life. King Xerxes is the man. And his bigness is meant to catch our ears. Man, this guy is, he's in position. He is in prominence. His title means mighty man. In fact, the title means the king of kings. King Xerxes is the king of kings. Whilst God is not named, King Ahasuerus' name comes up 167 times. He must like the sound of his own name. And we have this great, powerful, providential king. Here he is sitting on his throne. Can you picture it? Can you see him? He's powerful. He's in prominence. He has position. He has status. He has security. It is remarkable. He sits in comfort. He is kind of where most people would dream to be. So what does the most powerful man with the most powerful empire do? Well, he does whatever he wants. And he throws the most incredible party and festival and celebration the known world has seen. You see that in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and governors of the provinces were before him. So if you want to build political recognition, if you want people to see how splendid you are, how powerful you are, throw a banquet, invite the whole nations in. Everyone gets to see it. And you can't just do it over one day. You got to do it over 180. This is how it gets done. The most thing more impressive than his guest list was the party itself. It says, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days. 180 days. Self-indulgent, self-aggrandizing, 180 days. That is how much glory that everyone needs to see. That's how long it's going to take to partake in the glory of King Xerxes. I thought if I was to hold a party to show off my glory, we might be wrapped up by noon tomorrow. It wouldn't be very long. Carbon, thanks, the party's over, it's all done, head home. But not this king. And this king's really something. He's incredible. Now, children, your parents might be spectacular. They got power. They pay the bills. They provide roof over your head. But man, this guy is just on a next level. Verse 5, when the days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days. So there's the party, and then there's an after party. You know, what do you do when the party's over? You know, Jono from the back's like, let's have another party. And so they have another party for 7 days, a bit more intimate, a bit more exclusive. This is what's going down. This is kind of like Kanye's church, if you've seen this. It's kind of invite only. You got to sign non-disclosure agreements to go to Kanye West's church. It's wild. It's exclusive. It's prestigious. That's what's happening here. This guy's a big deal. Do you know how much of a big deal he is? Look at how opulent this feast is. Look at this, verse 6. There were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, and also couches of gold and silver. Parents, could you imagine if your couches were gold and silver? You'd sell it. On a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and precious stones, drinks were given in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds. And the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. And the drinking was according to this edict. There is no compulsion. Friends, the restraints are off. Do whatever the heck you want. For the king had given orders to all the staff of his palace to do as each man desires. This is the part when the MC at the wedding says, the bar is now open, and it is an open bar. The guests go wild. There's lavish drinking, there's party. It raises the question, is this the most godly way to start a story in the book of the Bible? Isn't the Bible meant to be about God? And this is a very godless beginning, isn't it? Drunkenness, revelry, self-aggrandization, idolatry. Where is God in this? Well, he seems quite absent. In fact, what we've got here is really just the secular world in view. We have materialism. We have consumerism. We have individualism. We have power. We don't even know where the creator is. We don't need the creator. We've got creation. The image is set up in front of us. This really is the secular vision of the good life. This is what the backbone of social media is. This is what the culture says to you. Seek this, and you too could matter. Seek this, and your life will count. In Hong Kong last year, there was this Flaunt Your Wealth Challenge. You can see these pictures here of rich Asians falling out of their expensive vehicles, demonstrating the luxury of their wealth. They did this. The next photo, you see them again, different car. There's Gucci handbags, there's Prada shoes, there's expensive Tiffany & Co. I mean, this is like the opulence. This was this kind of idea of how do we pour out and show, just, oh, I just happened to fall out and show all my wealth. And then they got some parodies and satires came through, as you can see in this next photo, as this gentleman showed his life. Now, you look at that, we see this opulence, these Aston Martins, the Gucci bags, and you go, oh, well, gosh, I'm glad I'm not like that. In fact, we can see how ridiculous it is, isn't it? One person got fined for staging the photo on a pedestrian crossing. It's absurd, that kind of wealth, to be flaunting that in front of people. We don't have that kind of home. We don't have those kind of cars. We don't have those kind of bags. We're kind of free from that pursuit of consumerism, materialism, wealth, opulence, self-glory in front of us. We're free of that here. But I wonder, do we sometimes protect ourselves from coming into contact whether there is a little bit of self-glory in us by looking to extreme examples that are above us and saying, at least we're not like that. See, often not many of us compare ourselves to those who are quote unquote, below us, material wise. And so often we start to build this defense around our life, which says, at least I'm not like them. So my consumption, my materialism, my self-glory isn't actually that bad. Ben Cromwell, one of the members here at our church, he works with Raw Impact. He does trips over to Cambodia. And I was chatting with his wife, Renata. And he's telling his stories of this fisherman who fishes at nighttime to just provide food for his family, but it's not safe where the kids sleep back at the house. So he brings them out to the boat so they could sleep. And whilst he fishes, the problem is the children kept rolling into the water. And so they tied ropes to them so that when they rolled in, they'd be able to pull them back up and put them back on the boat to go to sleep. Now, children, some of you are like, I want to sleep on a boat. you've missed the point of the message. Some of you are wondering, gosh, we get to have our own room. We get to have a roof over our head. We are so thankful. See, this is the first thing that we're kind of struck with this guy. My gosh, at least I'm not like that. But my question for us is, well, what are you like? Do you ever pick up moments in your life where there is a little bit of self-glory put on display for others to see? Obviously, through the realm of social media, we get this avenue quite explicitly. I want people to see. I want people to notice. But it's not just through social media. It's through the rest of our lives. Is this compelled? Maybe like I'm not really into displaying the glory of my possessions, but I like a bit of displaying my glory in other ways. Maybe you think of how you dress or how much makeup you put on or what you kind of wear to show how that people would take notice and pay attention. Maybe your family, you really want to present your family that we got all together and it's good so others might give you kudos. Dare you potentially communicate that your family has some issues? Do you ever try and present a better picture? Do you want to ever have a more important job title? For me, I found that I wanted to impress people with my iTunes collection. How embarrassing. How amusing. How laughable. That somehow I would seek worth from people because they thought I had a great organized iTunes list that I'd purchased and not downloaded. We can cling to the smallest of things. We don't need empires. We don't need big parties. We don't need lavish displays of opulence. We just need a little bit of pride of the human heart to put our glory on display so that others would take notice. There's an invitation for reflection here. Self-glory can be self-deceiving. But it's at this critical juncture in the story that we actually stop and we pause and slow down and we start to ask the questions, hang on a sec, is this really the vision of the good life? Young people, is this really what you want when you grow up? You want to have the nice car, the nice house? Young adults, is this really where you want to aim your life to when your studies? Older people, are you still trying to chase this vision of prestige and power? Is this really what life is all about? Is this really of the King of Kings? Is this how you're supposed to be? King Xerxes, are you actually this powerful? Well, look here at the first little twist in the story that is Esther. King Xerxes exercises control over 127 provinces. He puts parties on for 180 days. He is powerful. He is prominent. Everyone should listen to him. Yet, his wife does not do as she is instructed. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, read drunk, he commanded Mehuman, Bestha, Habona, Bigtha, Abigtha, Zetha, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. Her name Vashti means beautiful. King Xerxes is not just about putting his possessions on display. Or in fact, he is. He sees his wife as a possession. She goes on display as well. Some commentators say the reference here to only a crown is that she was instructed to only
wear a crown. But look what happens.
Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. At this time, the king became enraged and his anger burned within him. We have here in the very first pages of Esther the little insight that nothing is as it seems. I thought people who are powerful and in control can control everything. I thought if you get everything sorted out, the money, the house, the position, then life just follows your instructions. All of a sudden, we see this not the case. You'd think this great king who's been honored by all would be honored by his wife. You'd think this great king is in control, but he's not. So now that you look back on all his wealth, all his power, all the people, all the provisions, it starts to seem, well, a little bit empty. I mean, how much power can this guy actually have? What's the point of having all that power if people can still go against what you say? This is where the second surprise twist comes in the story. After his wife has defied his command, there is some relational contention that exists. And then Xerxes does, after his wife has said, no, I will not come, Xerxes does what every husband would do. He privately, patiently, lovingly speaks with his wife. He brings her in. Hey, babe, you dog me in front of the boys. If you could just hold off on that. Just really trying to exercise reign and rule here, and you're just kind of bringing shade on me. If you just pull back, and he communicates his feelings, he apologizes for his actions, and the relationship is stronger than it's ever been. Oh, no, not exactly. In fact, what he does here is he goes and seeks legal advice. Gentlemen, if you and your wife are having issues and you need to see 7 people for legal advice to sort it out, you have bigger issues. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure towards all who were versed in law and judgment, the men next to him being Kashina, Setha, Admantha, Tarshish, Meres, Messina, Makun, the 7 princes of Persia and Media who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. So he goes to the cultural elites, the best of the best. The people that he knows will give him the instructions that he needs. And what is their wisdom? According to the law, what is to be done? The king asked to the queen Vashti, because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs. His concern is procedural, it is not emotional. He is concerned with his restoring his face, not the relationship. Verse 16. Then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has Queen Vashti done wrong, but against all the officials and all the peoples who are in the provinces of the king Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will be made known to all the women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt. Since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media, who have heard of the queen's behavior, will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. Do you pick up that these guys are a little bit insecure in their relationships? Do you pick that up? Listen. If you asked your wife to do something and she didn't do it, I'm not going to think, gosh, Tegan and I, we're on the rocks. She's going to find out about this. She's going to read some feminist book. It's all over. That's what these guys fear. What do they do? It says, if it pleases the king, let a royal order go out from him and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes so that they may not be repealed. That Vashti is never again to come before the king Ahasuerus, and let the king give a royal position to another who is better than she. This is that. Take that, Vashti. This will teach you for not doing what I say. So when the decree made by the king is proclaimed throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, just in case you're listening and you forgot how big it was, for it is vast, all the women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. This advice pleased the king and the princes, and the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, and to every people in its own language, that every man be master in his own household and speak according to the language of his people. Well, well, well. Finally, the women in the Persian Empire will fall in line.
What we've not been able to regulate, we will legislate. If you stand against us, this is what will happen. Mike Cosper observes, the message of Esther 1 is clear. Those who might resist the status quo are put on notice. Your dissent is not welcome. Your refusal to participate will result in exile. So you're sitting there going, whoa, this is quite intense. You should have strong feelings going on inside you at this moment, in this part of the story. How can such a power do that? How on earth are we going to stand up to a force like that? Those of you with a justice streak, you're going, this isn't right. How archaic, how barbaric. How do we deal with these powerful forces? Well, if you look a little bit closer, is it their power that's put on display? Or is it in fact an act of what we might call even impotence? See, what do you make of the king's response? Does his response sound like someone who is measured and in control and on top of things? Or do you get the picture of more a jester in a medieval picture who's drunk and lacks sense and proportion of consequence? And what do you make of Vashti's punishment? Can you see the humor in this? The very thing Vashti said she would not do was come to the king. The king said, therefore, you shall never come to me. And Vashti's like, dang, guess I'm not coming. It's humorous. He says, you didn't come to the party, you won't come to the palace. What do you make of this decree? Do you get the sense that their reaction was a little bit excessive? That their reaction was a little bit exaggerated? That they kind of played out worst case scenario pretty early on from this action? And in fact, isn't it quite ironic in this story? The thing they didn't want the women to find out is now spread to the whole nation so that every woman would in fact find out what Vashti did. They've just told the whole nation what went down, and they've obviously now put their imposition of what they will do about it. They will be masters. Can't the men be in control? Aren't the men in control in this story? Aren't they the ones wielding power and forces? Well, we need to look a little bit closer. In fact, you in this story, you might think that the women seem subservient to the men's requests. But in fact, it's the other way around. There's a subversive reading in this story that in fact, the real movers and the shakers of this story are not the men, but it's the women. They're the ones who call the shots. It's Vashti's defiance of the great king, which sets into motion a vacant throne where Esther would come in and take. It's Queen Esther's decisions of the book's hero that we're going to see, who gives instruction to the king, ends up getting half his kingdom. It's Haman's plots, the schemer, the villain of the story. But Haman only plots in consultation with his wife, listening to her ideas, her stories. So the face value, this reading looks like the men are really powerful. But in fact, they're displaying impotence. And they're the real movers and the shakers are actually underneath. In fact, it's the women who end up having the last laugh. They say, big doors swing on small hinges. Do you get the impression from chapter 1 that nothing is as it seems? Can you be invited into the story that is Esther for a moment and realize that nothing is as it seems? So we come to the end of the story here and we ask the question, well, Darren, what's going on in this story? It's almost like if something's presented this way, but then it gets flipped and reversed, and that would be right. See, there's some literary critical work that's been done on the Book of Esther. And the literary genre itself is in this carnivalesque theme. In fact, the whole book is very carnivalesque. It's this idea of masks and misdirection and reversals. The whole book actually comes up with this air of comedy. In fact, I want to invite us in our reading of Scripture to not read Scripture as some flattened text
that merely is like a document manual for how to look after and service your car, but rather it is there to come to life. And the book of Esther, in fact, is quite funny. It invites you to ask to see the funny side of life. Listen to Adele Boleyn describing the book of Esther. She says it is a comedy, a book meant to be funny, to provoke laughter. The book of Esther is the most humorous of the books in the Bible. Amusing throughout and at certain points uproariously funny. The comic aspects of the book are not incidental, merely to provide comic relief, but they are the essence of the book. They define the genre of the book and thus set the parameters according to which we should read it. We cannot appreciate the story unless we realize that it is meant to be funny. See, the approach of laughter is very important. Young people, if you're here following Jesus and you're wondering, what is the Christian life all about? Is it seriously? Is it just to be a serious thing without fun and joy? Well, no. It is to be joy. There is to be laughter. There is to be gladness. And there is a certain sense in which we can laugh at the absurdity of wickedness. Because we see wickedness that at the time seems so powerful, but give it some time, and in fact, it all comes unraveling. We're invited to laugh. We're invited to laugh at certain things. We're invited to laugh at the important people who wield their power, but only end up revealing their impotence and incompetence. Haman, for example, this guy later on, builds this death trap for Mordecai, and he's ready to bring Mordecai onto it, and he goes before the king, and it turns out that he, in fact, is headed for the death trap himself. There are these reversals. We can laugh at the advisors who seem powerful but need to resort to legislation to get respect. We can laugh at the concern that the wives would find out only to issue an edict where every wife did, in fact, find out. So what comedy does, comedy starts to blur the lines in the story. Comedy blurs the lines between us and them. Comedy gets behind our defenses and starts to reveal something to us. So listen in. Isn't it funny that people like us can care more about how much we put out in front of people so that they would like us? Isn't it funny that we can feel more secure when we try and force people to respect us? Isn't it funny that our reactions to people's non-compliance can sometimes seem quite exaggerated? Isn't it quite funny that we think people might like us more if we had more stuff? Do you see what Esther's trying to do? We can so obviously see it out there, but in reading them, we end up reading ourselves. But the comedy of Esther is not about critique. It's actually also about coping. In fact, we need the book of Esther to deal with the tragedies of life. We need to be able to have a book like this. In this week, we've seen oppression of women. We've seen idolatry of man. We've seen the abuse of alcohol. This book is going to bring up themes of genocide, sexual exploitation, all in full view. And guess what we will find ourselves doing? We will be laughing. Which raises the question, how can you laugh at something so horrible? Is this laughter simply an avoidance? Like many of us in Australia do? Do you remember when Steve Irwin died? Do you remember when Peter Brock died? Do you remember when Heath Ledger died? We may remember these Australians, iconic Australians, dying. But do you remember seeing jokes and memes posted about their death? Started spreading its way through social media. See, Australians often use laughter as a coping mechanism to avoid the harsh realities of life. That's not what Esther's doing. Esther's actually trying to help us use laughter to actually deal with the harsh realities of life. Esther invites us to laugh, not just to cope, but actually to hope. To have hope. In fact, Esther wants us to remember how the story ends. Psalm 126 says, "When the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dream.
Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with shouts of joy. I wonder, Liberty visitors this morning, would you like to be the kind of people that can see the events and circumstances of life and be able to laugh? Would you like to have the kind of hope that fills your mouth with joy, laughter? Would you like to be those who dream, those who aren't given over to cynicism, but those who have hope? See, Esther reminds us that there's a festival coming, that there's a party at the end, that deliverance is on its way. Right now, you might look and think, nothing's really happening in life. Have you ever felt that? Do you feel that now in your life? It doesn't seem like really much is happening. Doesn't really seem like God is up to much. In fact, I look at life and I just wonder if he's here at all. It doesn't seem like the presence of God is particularly evident. Well, the invitation for you this morning, if you feel that way, is to go looking and exploring for the hidden hand of God in your life. Maybe you've gone looking for these signs that he's at work and you're feeling empty-handed. Maybe you've been praying for the salvation of a family member, but they haven't yet come to faith. Maybe you've been asking for healing and the Lord hasn't seemed to answer it yes yet. Maybe you're longing to know purpose and direction in your job. Maybe you're longing just to have a job and it hasn't come yet. Maybe you're trying to make sense of why you haven't conquered that sin. Maybe you're trying to understand why the joy that you seem to have in your faith early on is no longer present. And God doesn't feel close, but he seems distant. Maybe you've been part of church for a while now, but as you look over the time you've spent, you wonder, has God actually done anything here? Has he done much in me? Has he even done much through us? It looks potentially like nothing's really happened. And I think that's where we find ourselves at the end of chapter one. We finish the chapter, and listen, nothing's really happened. The king is still on the throne. The Jews are still in exile, under oppression, and yet the queen's throne is now vacant. And it creates this vacuum-like moment in the story that raises the question, I wonder what will happen with the vacant throne. I wonder, will this king continue to reign? I wonder, will the Jews be restored as a nation? Esther is telling us, friends, nothing is as it seems. See, this vacant throne would vacuum up a person, a poor Jewish girl called Esther, and she would rise to power. See, this thought of at the end of this book, this chapter, you think, man, nothing's happened. But friends, what if it is a grand setup? What if this is the foundation for the brilliant reversal? What if it's just one giant plot line that has just begun to reel you in to see what God is going to do next? It doesn't seem like much to begin with, but you got to wait to see how it pans out. And I think that's the story of Jesus. Remember, Jesus was meant to be the Messiah, the powerful one to deliver his people. Yet, young kids, do you remember where Jesus came? Do you remember where he was born? In a stable? In Bethlehem? Kings don't get born in stables. Do you remember the life of Jesus? He rides into Jerusalem. He's praised by the people as the Messiah, only to die on a cross as a failed revolutionist. He was supposed to be a king, but he gets crucified a criminal. Centurion cried out, if you're really the Son of God, save yourself. Disciples following him, this wasn't how it was meant to go down. It seems like nothing's really happening. His body's laid in a tomb. It looks like death has the final word. Sin has won. Satan is victorious. Nothing is really happening. In fact, nothing has happened. He has failed. It's all over. Roll the credits. Leave the cinema with a sense of hopelessness and helplessness because it's done. And yet, nothing is as it seems. Because in 3 days, that stone was rolled away. Because Jesus walked out of that tomb. Because Jesus appeared to the very people who disbelieved him. Because Jesus ascended to heaven, sent his spirit to proclaim a message. that the king, in fact, is not dead, but he is alive and well. This is the divine gotcha moment, the brilliant reversal where nothing is as it seems. Jesus won by dying. He overcame by losing. He succeeds through apparent failure. And my prayer and my hope is that maybe you would get a glimpse of this hope this morning. I don't know the breadth or the depth or the distance of God that you may feel. You might feel like he's hidden right now. But Esther is designed here to give us hope. We said at the beginning, the book of Esther explores the question, how is it that we are still here? You're wondering that question yourself this morning. How are we still here? How are we still going? Well, by God's grace, you have put one foot in front of the other. By God's grace, you've gathered to worship Jesus. By God's grace, he is not absent from your life, but he is present. And I hope and pray that we would see this God who is working behind the scenes. Even when we are not able to see him, he still sees us. Let's pray.